This is Surrogacy, Baby. I'm Mike.
And I'm Kate.
And we're taking you along for the ride on our independent journey.
Welcome to episode one, Where to Begin. Since this is the first episode, I thought we should introduce ourselves to you so that you know who we are before we're taking you through this journey of ours. I'm Kate. And I grew up on the Central Coast, moved here when I was a kid, and stayed until college. That's when I went to the Bay Area, studied accounting, worked up there, and that is where I met Mike.
And that's me. I'm the Mike that everyone is speaking of. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I was born and raised in the Bay Area, and went to college there, same college as Kate. Met her adjacent to college. We didn't meet each other there, but afterwards we had common friends, started hanging out. I tried to court her for a lengthy amount of time, probably lengthier than I care to admit, but ended up working and we started dating. I've always been in technology, worked for a product company for 10 years in the Bay Area, and then we just decided it was kind of time for a move. I guess we got married down here, and one weekend a month, we were coming down to the Central Coast, and it just felt like vacation.
It was a great plan that
it was a master plan, is what it was.
To get you to fall in love with the Central Coast on your own, so it became your idea to move down here.
Hook, line, and sinker is what happened. So, yeah, we got married down here. I loved it, and pretty quickly after we got married and we got back to the Bay Area, I said, Let's get out of here.
It was about 7 months after we got married that we decided, and it was just a matter of you finding a job down here.
Yep.
And which thankfully it worked out. Did.
I lead the technology group at a digital agency here and love it. It's tough work, but hey, gotta make a living. And now we've been married about 6.5 years. 6.5 amazing years.
And now thinking about having kids and...
Which is something we've been hearing for 6+ years.
Yes.
When are you going to have kids?
Yes.
When are you going to have kids? And, you know, it's not necessarily something you should be asking married couples because you never know what their situation is. For us, we've been pretty open about the situation, but the main reason... Should I go into that?
Why don't we talk about the situation?
The situation. The main reason it's taken us so long is that I was diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2008, and that has been a huge struggle for me, even currently. I'm still in treatment, and, you know, I was diagnosed in 2008 and didn't really think anything of it. I knew I had been sick for a while, but I figured now I have a diagnosis. And I will get better. And that isn't really how things happen for me.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, I didn't really think that Lyme disease was going to affect my future in the sense of having kids. I thought, I'm sick right now. I'm unable to work. I'm unable to meet anybody. Thankfully, Mike just happened to be hanging out in my apartment all the time with my friend. So he kind of came to me, which was the only way I was able to meet someone in my state. And it was about 2011, maybe 2012, when I had watched a documentary called Under Our Skin. And it was the first time that I really understood the danger of having a kid while also having Lyme disease.
Yeah.
And I kind of just thought, oh, well, we'll figure something out. Maybe it's not that big of a risk, and kind of pushed it down because that was a huge thing that I didn't want to have to really have that be reality.
Yeah.
And it just kind of went along, and there was more research, and I learned more, and kind of became clear that there was a risk to my health. There was a risk to the baby's health.
In terms of passing Lyme on to the fetus and ultimately the child.
So in plain terms, the danger is if I get pregnant, my health will most likely be okay during the pregnancy. But after I deliver, like any kind of autoimmune disease, your body is trying to protect the child as much as they can when you're carrying the child, but afterwards your body kind of revolts.
Like a release.
And yeah. you have, your symptoms are even worse than they were before, and you crash, and, you know, that kind of is scary when you're thinking about trying to raise a infant.
Tiny human.
And being sicker than I already am right now. Yeah. And then in terms of the baby, the risks are a high increase of miscarriage. If you are able to carry to term, then the baby can, the Lyme can pass on to the baby. And, you know, depending on when the Lyme was passed on to the baby and where it affects the baby, it can go into the brain, it can go into different areas, and it can create a wide variety of problems with the baby. And, you know, you could deliver a healthy child, seemingly healthy, for, and then the Lyme disease comes out later. And the biggest problem with Lyme disease is when it goes into the chronic stage. And that's where I'm at right now. And, you know, I've, it's 2021 now, and I was diagnosed in 2008, and I still am not healthy. And so that's one of my biggest fears, is passing that on to my child yeah. and it becoming chronic and having no real way to help them and cure them. And I don't have a bad life, but my life is very much changed based on this disease, and I am not able to do so much that a normal 30-something-year-old yeah. could do.
And early to mid-30.
And I wouldn't want that to affect our child if we can avoid it. Yep. There's so many things we can't avoid, and there's going to be a lot of things that are not under our control. And this is one thing that we know the risks, and this is one thing that we can avoid. And, you know, there's another aspect where women who have had Lyme disease and they've had treatment and they are in remission, they want to get pregnant. They are able to get pregnant and take antibiotics throughout their entire pregnancy, and that reduces the risk of passing on the Lyme. There hasn't been enough research to know exact numbers, because you can have a quote of it reduces the risk to only about 2%, and then you can talk to doctor's offices and they say, well, it's more about 25%. And yeah. there's just like a, there's no real knowledge of it. And also, the effects of taking antibiotics your entire pregnancy, what it does to your gut, what that yeah. can potentially do to the baby, and for that not to be 100% or even 99% safe for yeah. passing the Lyme disease on, it just isn't a very good option. And that would only be helpful if I was in remission. And that's what we've been waiting for the past 6 years, for me to get into remission and be in a position to do this in the best way that, you know, we can. Unfortunately, I'm not in remission, but we just decided we didn't want to wait any longer.
Yeah. So, yeah, about 4-5 months ago or so, I think we kind of decided to just go for it, that we couldn't really wait. We weren't getting any younger, and we didn't want to wait anymore. Not being in remission, obviously, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in, you know, future episodes, but obviously there's things that Kate and I are both worried about in terms of, you know, taking care of the baby. But I think, you know, we're pretty confident that we can kind of figure out a way to deal with that. So at the end of the day, it seemed like we had two options in front of us. One was gestational carrier, surrogacy, and the other was adoption. And I think it was very appealing for us to have, you know, a child who has our genes and our strengths and flaws and idiosyncrasies. And so I think we kind of, we prioritized that higher, you know, and we started going down the path of learning more and figuring out what it would take to do that. And I think the first thing we realized is, well, I think there's two things we realized. One is, ooh, doggy, this is expensive. But even adoption, you know, there were...
Yeah, because that's the thing, is it was crazy to us to find out that adoption was as expensive as it was, and the timing and yeah. having to wait and not knowing what,
yeah,
you know,
the
situation is. And it just... Yeah. No, neither was going to be, like, super clear yeah. steps, and timing exactly like you wanted and the cost right where you wanted it to be.
Yep. So thing number two that we learned very quickly, and I say we, the royal we, but it was really Kate doing a lot of research, found that it's a long process and there's a lot of steps and a lot of different paths you can take. And so that's really why we're here recording this. And just, I told Kate we should, while we're in the middle of it and while all the information is fresh in our head, sit down and record our thoughts. And our whole goal is to kind of describe the process and help others who are in a similar situation with understanding how to get through this. Because it ain't easy.
Well, and I feel like when I was trying to get information, there are places out there to get some information, but you have to do a lot of piecing together things, and I wasn't finding exactly what I needed, and I was able to get into contact with some people that were super nice and very friendly and willing to help, and that was so helpful for me, and I just thought, we're in this position, it'd be nice to be able to help other people and pay that forward. Because it's such an emotional thing, and it's really hard with the emotions of it, and then just to not know exactly how to go about it and what the steps are, and, you know, all of that just adds on to it, making it even harder.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, really the first, you know, after we decide, well, let's flash back a couple years prior to deciding to move forward to surrogacy, there is the first step of, you know, part of surrogacy is transferring an embryo into your gestational carrier, your surrogate.
Yeah, I would say that we didn't do anything backwards, but we kind of did step one, you know, before we were ready to do surrogacy. And that was just because of my situation and what blood tests showed. But that's kind of the thing, is like the very first thing that you need to do now, if it's a reason that you can't carry because of a health issue, there's also, obviously, most women don't carry because they have tried themselves to carry and they haven't been able to, and so they're already in that kind of thread of things. They're already, when you're trying yourself to get pregnant and you're trying different things like IUIs and you go to IVF, and you're already kind of in that whole embryo creation world. But I do see a lot of women don't even know what to do. They've been trying to get pregnant. They don't really know what the first step is. And it's always, the first step is you need to find a doctor and you need to figure out what your personal situation is. And that has to do with your hormone levels, your egg levels, all of that kind of information.
And we were kind of, I mean, you could say lucky in a way that we only had one doctor in San Luis Obispo. For those that don't know, San Luis Obispo's reasonably small town on the central coast of California, kind of halfway between the Bay Area and LA. I think we have a population of about 60 or 80,000, and a quarter of that is a college. So there's only one kind of like reproductive specialty doctor, and so we went to him.
Yeah, that made it easy. We just really had one.
Yeah, we didn't have to look. We didn't have to pick, which, as you'll see throughout this podcast, picking things is sometimes difficult for us. But
yeah,
but here we are. So yeah, you went to Dr. Steinleitner.
Yeah, so I had originally gotten tested just at my regular gynecologist. I had gotten my AMH level tested, and that is just your ovarian reserve level. And, you know, at the time I got tested, I believe I was 32, and I got tested and it was extremely low. And so that was my first sign of, like, this might be a little bit harder for us than we thought. And we weren't ready. And that was, I think I got it tested in 2016. We weren't ready at all to have a child, but I just wanted to see where things were. My sister was struggling with fertility, and so I thought it would be a good idea for me to get tested. When I found out my number, it was 0.35, which at my age, it was really a number that someone in their 50s should have. Mm-hmm. So that's when we went and I looked up doctors here in San Luis, went to the specialist. He did a bunch of other blood work, which is what you will start with. And they will test all your hormones on certain days of your cycle. And together, they will create this picture of what your fertility health is. So, yes, I had a really low AMH level. Sometimes when you have a really low AMH level, your other hormone levels are perfectly normal and you don't have as big of an issue. My issue was that my AMH level was really low, but also my other hormonal levels were just really weird and not normal. Some were too low, some were too high. So the doctor looked at all of that and decided that it would be best if we created embryos right away. He said that if I was going to be trying for a child on my own without IVF, without surrogacy, that I could still get pregnant. It might take me longer, but the problem is that when you do surrogacy, you have to have a larger number of embryos, and my hormonal levels were making it so that I wasn't going to respond as well to the medicine and I wasn't going to create as many embryos, leaving our chances for a good quality embryo to put into a gestational carrier. Those chances wouldn't have been as good if I waited years.
Yeah. So very quickly became, and this was, I think, a shock to both of us that we kind of had to decide very quickly to harvest eggs from you and then subsequently make embryos that, mm-hmm. and I'm a fan of science. I still can't believe these things can sit in cryogenic storage for mm-hmm. years and years and years and still be usable. That's crazy. But we kind of started that process going through it, which I think that we realized during that process that was a lot tougher at certain points than we kind of expected.
Well, it was a lot sooner than we had expected to really have to
deal with it
and yeah. decide. And it was kind of like this ticking clock of, well, if you don't get your embryos now, created now, and you want to wait 2-3 years down the road, you might not be able to get enough embryos to have yeah. a viable pregnancy. And so we had to really decide. I think that testing was done at the very end of 2016. I think I got the results at the beginning of 2017. And we had to decide, do we spend this large amount of money to create these embryos, not knowing at what point in the future we would use them, if we would use them, mm-hmm. because we knew at that point surrogacy was going to cost us a lot of money. We knew at that point we didn't have the money to pay for the full surrogacy journey, no. and we were wondering, do we spend the money now to create the embryos and potentially not have the money down the road to use them?
Yeah. And I this was perception number one that was shattered in my mind, was I think I had only been thinking about the costs of getting the embryo. For whatever reason, label me a classic guy, that was kind of the thing that was on my mind. And, you know, very quickly we realized, okay, it's somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 to harvest and store your embryos. When all said and done with transferring it into a surrogate and, you know, bringing the child to bear, that $10,000 to $20,000 is only minimum one fifth of the total cost. I mean, surrogacy can be anywhere between $80,000 and $120,000. You know,
I would up that.
Yeah,
I would say most are about $100,000 to $150,000 at this point. So we were looking back in 2017, the numbers were lower. It's only gone up as the years have gone by.
Just like college, just keeps going up. So yeah, I think that was thing number one. We had to decide, okay, if we spend $10,000 to $20,000 harvesting an embryo, there's a chance we may never use it. And so we kind of, I don't know if you had, I think we talked about this, but in my mind, it was basically, and this starts to get into a topic we're going to talk a lot about in subsequent episodes, just the finances of it and how it seems so businesslike when you're talking about something so foundational to, you know, life. of giving birth, it's weird to talk about it in terms of a contractual agreement and a financial, you know, so, yeah. So we had to think of it as a down payment, basically, that potentially we may never get that money back. And, you know, if for whatever reason we couldn't use them for surrogacy, we weren't going to use them through any other means. So, you know, it was really weird to think about that level of investment that, you know, potentially we might not use.
Especially right, you know, at the beginning of our marriage.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had bought a house the year prior. It wasn't like we had a bunch of extra income that we, you know, had.
I didn't have offshore accounts.
Yeah. But we were feeling the pressure of, you know, I think for me it's hard because obviously I have a lot of emotions still about the whole thing of me not being able to carry. And I think back then, especially in 2017, I wasn't ready to completely give up. And it was something that we hadn't even decided when we were going to have kids. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, might not be able to have biological children. We had just seen our nephew born and had, you know, the prior 9 months with him, and he was amazing. We got to see, you know, my grandpa in him who had died before he was born. And it was these things that we were just having all these new experiences with our nephew. And then all of a sudden we had to make a decision. Well, you either pay $20,000 right now for a chance, mm-hmm. or you save that money and know that you pretty much are saying no to having biological children.
Yep.
And we felt this
pressure
of trying to decide that right then. And it was difficult. And we just decided, we obviously decided to go forward with it. And I think, you know, it was a risk of that $20,000. And, you know, some people can make embryos for less than that. But because of the situation that we were in with how bad my numbers were and my hormones, we needed to do a
alternative.
Yeah, it was, you know, we were given a couple different options. But because of my situation, I had to go through a couple cycles. And it ended up being, you know, $20,000 because of that.
Yeah.
And then we tested the embryo, so it ended up being $25,000.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So without going too far into detail.
Yeah, you go on a bunch of different medicines. And so the way that I had to do it was we decided to do mini cycles for me. So we were going to do 4 mini cycles. And I chose this instead of the traditional IVF route because the doctor had said I would need the highest level of fertility medicine, and that would be about 6,000 more than the just traditional drugs that a woman would get with somewhat normal hormone levels. So he said, you're going to spend more money. You're going to be injecting even higher amounts of drugs into your system, and you're not going to get that many more eggs. You're probably going to get 4 to 6 eggs if you do that. And it's going to be a lot harder and it's going to be more expensive. And you're going to have to do this more than once. So the other option were these mini IVF cycles where I actually took a super high dose of Clomid, which is something that a lot of women in really small amounts will take for IUIs. And we did a really high amount of that plus some other injectable drugs, and we were ready to do 4 mini cycles, and we were hoping to get somewhere between 1 and 4 or 2 and 5 eggs per cycle, knowing that at 32, not all of our eggs were going to be normal or not going to not succeed, but not going to make it to the 5-day. And so that's what we ended up doing. And so my first transfer was in March. So I think we got the results of my blood work in January. By March, I was doing my first retrieval. I will say, because it was mini cycles and they didn't expect me to get very many eggs, we had decided that I wouldn't be put under for the retrieval. And that would be my biggest suggestion or a piece of advice, is when you're going through it, definitely take the drugs to get put under or in under twilight or whatever it is that they do, because you don't want to be awake and feeling the pain because it was extremely painful.
Yeah.
So we went through the first one, you know, going through egg retrievals. It's definitely rough on the woman. I think the man doesn't know at all what is going on in your body. They don't have the symptoms.
I can confirm that.
You know, they don't get the hot flashes and the headaches and just the emotional aspect of it and the bloating and all of that kind of thing. But luckily, I do fairly well on hormones. So while it wasn't the best situation, I was able to handle it fairly well. Giving myself the shots wasn't too bad. Mike actually gave me the trigger shot, which went well. I was a little bit worried about that, but he actually did really well with that.
Yeah, just be warned, if you're terrified of needles or you just don't dig them, you gotta figure out a way to get past that, because there's a number of injections. You had to do one a day for a while. Or...
Yeah, and if you do normal IVF and not do the Clomid part of it, you do a lot more injections than I even had to do.
And then I think I had to do two or three at the very end or something like that.
Yeah, and you have to figure out how to mix everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's like a lot to it.
Home doctor set.
Yeah. And I have no problem with needles. I get blood work done all the time and medical treatments and all of that. But it's still giving yourself a shot is still not
nerve-wracking.
Yeah, you know, you still have to talk yourself up a bit before you stick it in your stomach.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we did the first one and we had really good results and it was amazing. And I think that first round we got 7.
Yeah.
And the doctor was amazed, and that's probably also why I should have been put under, because it was a lot longer.
Yeah.
But it was such great success that we were just amazed. And
well, it's kind of the first thing that had gone right for us.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, the fact that the doctor had said in these mini cycles you only get 1 to 4, and I'm sitting in the waiting room and the doctor comes out and says we got 7, and he didn't look surprised. And then I was surprised, and I kind of said, wait, what? And he said, yeah, I don't see this very often. I was like, it was just crazy. It was one of the first things to go right in the process, which was exciting.
It was nice, too, going through all that pain. I'm like, well, at least
totally
it was 7
it.
Eggs, and it wasn't just one.
Yeah.
And so from those 7 eggs, we actually created 5 embryos. So we were super excited about that, but we know the percentages of having a normal embryo, but then also once you freeze and thaw them, and then once you use a gestational carrier, it's not 100%. So you have to have quite a bit more than the children that you want.
Well, and just, I mean, because I think it's good, it's a good thing, your doctor should tell you this, but it's important to know that I think of course, no doctor is going to give a, you know, firm percentage on this, because it depends on the person and the environment and any number of factors. But it was, I remember him saying something like 50% of the eggs you get will be viable.
Mm-hmm.
And
it depends on your age too. But
yeah. And then only 50% of the actual embryos you create will probably be viable. And I think that was a fairly conservative way to look at it is, okay, so if we got 8 eggs, there's a good chance only 25% of those will be viable. So that's 2.
Yeah.
So that's kind of something you have to realize going in, is that you kind of have to shoot for a higher number than just, you know, you got to have a bank of them. If, you know, say you want 3 kids, you can't just have 3 embryos.
Especially in our situation where we were trying to get as many eggs and as many embryos created while I still had eggs, because we knew that we weren't going to be doing surrogacy right then. And if we waited 3-4 years and we didn't have enough embryos, we wouldn't have the ability to create more embryos.
Yeah.
So that was also a factor in it. So we did the first egg retrieval. And so then we tried to do a second one right away. And
like
that,
the next cycle, the next month.
So that was in April. And that one fell apart. I didn't do well on the drugs, and I ended up ovulating too quickly, and we just had to cancel that cycle. We waited one more month in between, and so the second cycle that I did was in June. And that one didn't go as well, but we still, it was very successful still because I got 5 eggs that time and 3 turned into viable embryos.
Yep.
And that was a lot harder on my body, which is interesting because we were going to do it in April and that was just the first month afterwards. I don't know how that would have, how been the different. Healing would have been. Yeah. You know, I would have thought 2 months in between would have been enough, but I had a lot more pain and just the healing of it was a lot longer. Yeah. And I was not wanting to do a third cycle. Originally, we were going to do 4 mini cycles and we thought, well, the first one went so well, we might only need to do 3. And then we did the second one and we ended up in total between the 2 cycles having 8 embryos. And we thought, you know, we want 2 children at least. So is that 8 embryos enough? The doctor couldn't really tell us, you know, because they don't know how the embryos look and all of that kind of thing. And the only suggestion was that we could test them. So we did PGS testing. And that basically just looks to make sure that they have the correct number of chromosomes. And it doesn't look really at anything else, the genetics of it, what other, you know, issues that can develop. But it does give you that first step that you have to, you know, that first hurdle that you have to cross is like, there enough chromosomes?
It's kind of like the building blocks of the embryo are, you know, or the right number of cards in the deck or whatever metaphor you want to use. But chromosomally viable, I think, was the the term that if they're positive, that, that, you know, it's just they have the right number, they're in the right places, all that good stuff.
So our percentage when we transfer them are going to be, you know, higher than if we didn't have them tested. So we had...
Now, sorry, important to note, testing them does expose them to a little risk. You have to sign waivers that say, hey, the act of doing this could, you know, we can make a mistake. Mm-hmm. We could,
because they have to take a biopsy.
Yep, of a tiny embryo,
very tiny embryo, and
so that was a little scary. We definitely, at least for me, I don't know about you, but it.
Yeah, it's all these risks in this process that you have to weigh: is it worth doing or not doing? And there's never just 100% like this is the right decision that you're making. It's probably a very good lesson and practice for parenting.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the thing of like which side of it do we land on. With the testing, part of it was, were we going to put my body through another retrieval? And after the June one, I really wasn't wanting to do a third one. I was going to do a third one if we needed to, but
I didn't really want you to do a third one either. It was rough seeing you go through it.
Yeah, and so we decided, you know, it was going to be an extra $5,000 to test them, but we kind of thought, well, we could save some money by not doing the third and the fourth cycle. We ended up not being able to save as much money as we thought because we were a little unclear as to the payment, but we saved the money on the medicine that I would have to take. We saved the surgical center fee. We saved the, you know, the lab fee. So we did save money by having them tested, and in the end we tested them and miraculously all 8 of them were normal. And
I do want to point out a piece of advice, I think, we should keep count on how many, but the thing I didn't realize about the IVF process is that it's a fixed fee engagement, and so I didn't realize, you know, with the mini IVF process, they kind of book you or plan to do 4 extractions. And what I didn't know is if you got enough eggs after 2 or 3 and you didn't need the third or the fourth, you still paid the full amount. And I think had I known that, I would have tried to see if we could kind of negotiate that or something. Because that, you know, after you went through the first one, and then even more so the second one, we were like, well, we don't want to do any more of these. We don't have to.
And I had thought that I had checked with the doctor's office at the beginning of it all. And I had thought that if we didn't want to go forward with, you know, cycle 2, 3, 4, that we wouldn't have to pay that extra amount.
Yeah.
But I guess that was wrong. So that's one thing I would say is just be really clear and also keep notes and keep emails between you and the doctor's office.
Yeah, keep. That's a really good point, because I think there were a couple places we wish we would have, we kind of agreed to something on the phone or talked about something on the phone. They either said, you know, a stat or a next step or something, and it made it tough because we would talk to someone else and they would say, oh no, that's not what you're supposed to do. So,
and I think that throughout the whole process,
keeping a paper trail.
Yeah, keeping a paper trail, that will help you, because people don't always remember what they tell you, and you're going on things that you, you know, think are true, and then all of a sudden you're paying 10,000 more than you thought, or 5,000 more, whatever it ends up being.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but all that's to say, we ended up spending, you know, $25,000 to create these embryos
and test them.
And thankfully, and, you know, it's not something the doctor sees all that often, but again, it was another part in the process that really went our way. And we were super thankful that all eight were normal. That doesn't mean all eight are viable. You know, I think we found out this year that we only have, I think, five of them are good and three of them are fair. Yeah. So that's actually something that I wish we had known back when we were creating them. Not that the fair embryos can't, you know, be viable. It just would have been better if all of them were good they had been great, or, you know.
I laugh because it's just a weird
And I think,
scale.
Like, different clinics grade them differently. So what our clinic is telling us, I believe that there is great, good, fair, and poor. Now, there's other methods of grading them, and they use A, B, C, and sometimes it's an AA or an AB or, you know, a BC. And so each clinic kind of does it differently. I'll talk about this more later on, but I think when you're picking a clinic, something that's important is to look at their percentages and look at their history of viable pregnancies and that kind of thing. And we sort of just stumbled into ours, and we are in a small town, and so we really only had one doctor. We could have traveled to do it, but we kind of just ended up with a doctor in whatever clinic he worked with. That's what we worked with, and now that's where we're at. And thankfully, the clinic that we're working with has good percentages and good track records, and it's a good place to work with. But that is one thing that we didn't really even know to think about when we were creating embryos. We're just like, well, we just go to this doctor and we're going to create embryos. And something we probably should have done more research about doctors and clinics, and, you know, knowing that we would, I mean, now I know, I didn't know back then, but we are now working with the clinic that our embryos are at. And that's like a very important part of the whole process. And, you know, we kind of just lucked into a clinic that has
seems
a good reputation.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we sat about 3 years ago with eight viable embryos. And I think another big reason to check to do that test is that, again, it's kind of one of these things, you're making such a financial investment, an investment in your time and your body, that you want to make sure you're set up for success whenever you end up using the embryos.
Yeah, so we decided, we had the eight embryos, they were all chromosomally normal, and so we were just going to stop at that point. We figured we have a good chance of being able to get two children out of those embryos, and we're going to not put my body through it anymore and just wait. And so from 2017 until now, we just have been paying the storage fees and kind of waiting to see what happens in our lives and what happens with our financial situation and see if we were going to end up using them.
Yeah.
And that brings us to, it was August of last year, 2020, that we decided, you know, my health has had a lot of ups and downs in the past 3 years, some very, very bad downs. And there hasn't been as much improvement as we would like. And it's sort of become more apparent that getting into full remission just isn't something that is going to happen right away.
Yeah, we can't wait for it.
I hope that it does happen, and that's what I'm still constantly doing treatments and going to doctors and on my program and trying everything. But it was stopping us from having a family because we were, you know, trying to wait for this perfect time. And not that it's not going to be hard with me being so sick, but I don't want, you know, the Lyme disease has taken so much from me and I don't want it to take even more. And like we said, we're not getting younger. And so we decided, yeah, in August, like, you know, let's see if we can make this happen. Let's really think about it. Let's start researching it more. And, you know, go from there. Because we had just done a little bit of research when we did the embryos and, you know, so much had changed. So we were like, let's start it.
This is where my memory may not be quite what it was in reality, but it reminded me of our roles reversed when we were in the Bay Area. It was similar to when we were in the Bay Area. And I think one day I just came home and I said, what if we just moved to SLO after our lease is up in the Bay Area? And I think that you kind of looked at me like,
well, I think I was kind of resistant to it a little bit because we had our life in the Bay Area that was great. We had our friends up there and, you know, I really liked being up there and what we could do in the Bay Area. And I had always thought, well, we would move down to San Luis, like when we start to have a family or when I'm, you know, healthy and I want to go back to work and all that stuff. And so I was like, well, this isn't part of the plan. Like, we still have the stuff to do in the Bay Area. And you were
we have a checklist to get through.
And you were just like, well, what are we waiting for? And I was like, well, that is a very good question.
Well, and, you know, we had a lot of friends in the Bay Area that were pretty centrally located to where we were, kind of in the South Bay. And over time, a lot of people understandably moved away because the Bay Area is ridiculous in terms of cost of living. So, you know, people were still quote unquote in the Bay Area, but the Bay Area is a big place and it made it a little.
My best friends were still up there, so that was a bit hard for me.
But I think you realized you were going to see them regardless, even if we were 2 or 3 hours away.
I mean, with the way that technology is now, it's so much easier.
So anyway, I recall there was just a conversation we had in the car or something where you just kind of said, you know,
well, I think pretty much just do this. Well, I think what's funny is you remember it that way because I remember it the same exact way as the move that you really like pushed for it. Because I think I sort of, you know, moving to San Luis, having children, like not that you don't want to have children, but they're all things that I wanted to do eventually. But I kind of just like waited for you to get the urge to do it right now. Mm-hmm. And I think like having kids and doing it through the surrogacy process, it's costing us a lot of money. And also, you're going to have to do a lot more work than the stereotypical, you know, dad. So I didn't want to push you into those things if you weren't really ready for it. So,
and it's in my mind, I think I had already kind of signed on for doing that, but never told you that.
And I think it's so funny because it was a car ride home from a vacation with my family where we had just spent 2 weeks with our nephew and niece, day in and day out. And, you know, it's a 2 and a 4 year old and, you know, it can get crazy and they're constantly wanting to play and, you know, it's a lot of energy and, you know, we love them so much, but it's definitely seen a day in and day out of, you know, waking up and bedtimes and meal times and the meltdowns and that kind of thing. So I thought it was pretty funny that it was the drive home from that trip that you were like, yeah, let's do this. Let's do but I think that's when we decided, like, what are we really waiting for? We know that it's going to be difficult, and we'll talk more about that in terms of how we are planning to balance my illness with having a child and the demands of that. But we decided, you know, let's see if we can do this. Yeah. And we didn't know too much. Hey, guys. So this episode was a lot longer than we thought. So we decided to split it up into two parts. So come back for part B to hear what we knew, how we got started, and our thoughts on starting the surrogacy process.
We hope to see you next time.